You're listening to History Out Loud, Chat from the Stacks, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries. Presented by Jill Carpenter. So, back with History Out Loud again for another episode with Sarah Browning. And it's going to be another transatlantic special, so I shall be relying on Sarah's knowledge on American history that is somewhat lacking in my brain.
It's optimistic for you to rely on me. I appreciate the vote of confidence.
So this episode, we're going to be covering a chap called Buffalo Bill and his Wild West shows. And you might be wondering, well, what's that got to do with local history? And to be fair, I probably thought the same, and you did as well, didn't you, Sarah?
Yeah, I really didn't know a whole lot about Buffalo Bill at all.
I discovered him in the Brown Envelopes, which, if you haven't been into local studies, is just our collection of newspaper clippings that we keep in drawers, and they're small manila brown envelopes. And, you know, you can find out information on virtually anything local history-wise. So they're a great resource. I love the smell when you open the drawers. You, yes. That manila smell. Mm. So I wouldn't have been looking for Buffalo Bill, but I think I must have been flicking through for something else and thought, Buffalo Bill? Really? So, yeah.
The Tubman News, their office used to have a similar filing system, and when it closed down, they gave Todd Library boxes and boxes of their equivalent, their little brown manila envelopes, and I remember coming across one that was just marked Koi Carp. I was like, what? There's always a treasure to be found in these things. Like, why do we have this? Why who put this together?
Yeah, randoms. So Buffalo Bill does indeed have a connection to Halifax, but first we should probably cover who he actually was. So his name that he was born with or given after birth is William Frederick. Yeah, I know. Is William Frederick Cody, and he was born in February in 1846 in a place called LeClaire, Iowa. His family later settled in what was termed as Kansas Territory. Now, I don't really understand the territory situation. Perhaps you could fill us in a little bit on that, Sarah.
Yeah, well, the short version of this is that almost all the land west of the Mississippi River was obtained by the U.S. government in sort of one fell swoop. It was called the Louisiana Purchase, and Thomas Jefferson was one of the people who negotiated it, because originally all that land belonged to France. And after they did that, settlers started to go out from the East Coast and settle different parts of the country. And there was this idea of manifest destiny, which I don't know if British listeners have come across that in their reading or not, but it was this idea that America belonged by God-given right to the Americans. And by Americans, I don't mean Native Americans, I mean white Americans. Hmm. It was God's deliverance that they had beaten the British and been able to establish their own country. And the sort of the taming of the West and the civilizing of the West was part of this idea that we were allowed to do this. This is our destiny. This is our obligation. But after Louisiana Purchase, there were a lot of other sort of conflicting pressures upon the U.S. government, one of which was slavery. And because there was already an abolitionist movement, and there was already a great deal of difference of opinion about whether or not we should be continuing with slavery or not, what ended up happening was people would settle areas and they would become territories. And then after a certain amount of time, or once they got to a certain number of settlers, or they'd established, you know, a provisional government of some sort, they would apply for statehood. But statehood wasn't just given out willy-nilly, because the government had to consider whether it would be a slave state or not. And at one point we started getting sort of only two states allowed at a time. So one would have slaves, one wouldn't. And yeah, so it was very complicated. But at this point, Kansas, it would have been an established territory, but statehood had not yet appeared on the horizon for it, even though we know it now as a state.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. So his father was called Isaac and his mother was Anne Bonsall Laycock. In the years before the Civil War, there was a lot of conflict in Kansas over the slavery question, as you've sort of touched on there. Isaac Cody was against slavery. He was invited to speak at a local trading post where pro-slavery men often held meetings. But his anti-slavery speech angered the crowd so much that they threatened to kill him if he didn't step down. And he didn't step down. And the man jumped up and stabbed him twice with a knife.
Thanks.
So he never fully recovered from this and eventually died of respiratory illness and other complications, probably brought on by this attack. And this was in April 1857 that he died. I think it's probably quite important to mention his father's views for context for when we later discuss Bill's shows and the inclusion of Native Americans in these shows.
Mm.
He's described as an American soldier, bison hunter and showman, which tells you quite a bit, I think, about the type of person we're dealing with.
Yes.
After the death of his father, family were in financial hardship, understandably, and at age 11, Bill took a job with a freight train as a boy extra. Have you heard of that, Sarah?
No, I actually hadn't heard of that term before.
So this is when they ride up and down on horseback alongside the length of a train and deliver messages between the drivers and the workmen, which sounds kind of crazy, but it would be necessary because the only way the driver would be able to talk to anyone at the back of the train would he'd have to climb out and go across the roof otherwise. So, yeah, this was probably quite a common job to have in those days.
Well, wagon trains would be so long. I mean, that's the thing. You had to travel in numbers for safety. And yeah, you would have wagon trains that you'd need somebody going up and down constantly relaying messages back and forth just to make sure everybody was on the same page about, you know, when we're stopping, what does everybody need, what's going on, you know, just information sharing. So
yeah. After this job, he joined Johnston's army as an official member of the scouts assigned to guide the United States Army to Utah during the Utah War. I don't know much about the Utah War. I'm hoping Sarah knows a little bit.
Yeah, it was complicated. Essentially what happened was that the Mormons, the Church of Latter-day Saints, they had moved out to Utah because they were facing persecution out east, which some of that was genuine, some of that was sort of manufactured and exaggerated by Joseph Smith, their leader, their prophet, in order to sort of, you know, maintain coherency and keep control of the group. And they went out west, but they essentially became extremely paranoid. And there was an incident where some settlers were passing through Utah on their way to California. And for one reason or another, the Mormons there killed them and then tried to blame it on Native Americans. And it started a chain of events that essentially led to the army having to be sent in to maintain control, which ultimately they sort of succeeded. But I mean, Utah is still the main base for the Church of Latter-day Saints. So they still maintain a very, very strong presence there. But yeah, it was sort of and as we have seen multiple times throughout American history, that sort of strong distrust of government, strong distrust of, you know, Eastern elites, et cetera, leading to conflict in the West.
I mean, it sounds like quite a dangerous job, really, scouting in this situation. Mm. And that's why it's interesting, because he's still a boy. He's still a child, basically, while he's doing this.
Yeah. He's packing a lot in.
Yeah.
The thing to remember is everybody then has guns as well. So he may be young and it may be a dangerous job, but he probably was taught how to handle a weapon, you know, before he was 10 years old. So it wasn't unusual to see, you know, to see young boys doing jobs like this that would have been quite dangerous by today's standards, certainly. It's yeah. just part of life living in the West at that point.
So in 1860, and at this point, he's still a boy, he's age 14, he briefly got caught up in the gold rush. But before that could take hold, he met an agent for the Pony Express. So I think I know what the Pony Express is. Express mail service, horseback, used to relay messages between riders across from Missouri to California. He signed with them, and after working with them, building several stations and corrals, he was eventually given a job as a rider, which is quite exciting. But we should probably say at this point that he claimed to have all sorts of kinds of jobs. These included trapper, something called a bullwhacker. I had to look that one up, which is a bullock driver. So I suppose that's herding cows, isn't it? Something called a 59er, which is to do with the gold rush, isn't it? All right.
Yeah, that particular gold rush he was caught up in, because there were quite a few for all different parts of the US.
1859, is that what it's referring to? 59er. Yes. Wagon master, stagecoach driver, and a hotel manager, which sounds quite tame really by comparison
at that point. Maybe he's feeling his age by, you know, 16 or whatever.
Yeah, I suppose he had to get his pipe and slippers out at some point. Historians have had difficulty documenting some of these jobs, though, so he may have fabricated some for publicity.
Well, he's a showman, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a showman, yeah, which is similar to another person that we've covered on previous podcasts, Alfred McKill, who was responsible for the creation and running of the Halifax Zoo and amusement park. And he was larger than life, but you never quite knew what was real and what wasn't when he was talking.
Yeah. Well, if it makes for a good show, who cares? That's the thing. People wouldn't have been able to find out for themselves, and they probably wouldn't have cared to anyway.
It has been said, in contrast to Cody's claims, that he never rode for the Pony Express. But as a boy, he did work for its parent company, the transport firm of Russell Majors and Waddell, where his real job was to carry messages on horseback from the firm's office in Leavenworth to the telegraph station, which was 3 miles away.
A little bit different.
A little bit different, yeah. I mean, I don't want to believe that. I want to believe it was in the Pony Express. Anyway. After this, he wanted to enlist as a soldier in the Union Army during the American Civil War, but he was refused because, guess what, he was still too young. He then began working with the freight caravan that delivered supplies. Finally, in 1863, at age 17, he enlisted as a truck driver and teamster. Do you know what a teamster is?
Yes. Well, going back to bullwhacker, it's basically somebody who drives a team of cattle, horses, whatever. But yeah, that's where the term originates for the Teamsters Union and groups like that. It was originally people who managed herds of livestock of some sort.
So he joined them in rank of private and served until discharge in 1865. After this, he enlisted as a scout at Fort Ellsworth. Established a short-lived settlement with a man called William Rose, and this settlement was called Rome.
Aspirational.
Yeah. In 1867, with the construction of the Kansas Pacific Railway, he was granted leave of absence to hunt buffalo to supply railroad construction workers with meat. This is presumably where he got the name Buffalo Bill.
Yes.
He's supposed to have killed 4,282 buffalo in 18 months. That's quite some going, isn't it, really?
It is, but it wasn't, it's not a surprise really, because this is one of the more, one of many more shameful aspects of American history in terms of how Native Americans were treated, which is that there's a massive drive to kill buffalo, and buffalo were more or less eradicated over a very short period of time. And some of that was to get food, but the vast majority of buffalo was just killed and left. And again, going back to Manifest Destiny and the civilization of the West, you know, a lot of Native American tribes were nomadic. They followed the buffalo. Buffalo was a major part of their life. It was not just part of their sort of day-to-day living routine or a food source. It was a trading asset to them, hides, things made from the hides, the furs, the meat. It was an important spiritual element for them, for a lot of them. And there really was a sort of outlook from the American settler side that, you know, part of Christianizing and civilizing the Native American is going to be about removing this from their lives, more or less. So you can find photographic evidence of just massive piles of dead buffalo just left to rot. And yeah, it really, I mean, good on Buffalo Bill for killing buffalo to feed people, but that is just a very small element of what was happening in regards to buffalo at that time in the US. So it's taken a very long time to reestablish herds of buffalo out west. It's been a very intensive movement to bring them back.
Yeah, it's really sad. We could continue with Buffalo Bill's illustrious feats of daring do, but that would be probably to gallop off in completely the wrong direction as far as this episode is concerned. So we'll leave it there. Apart from to say he married Louisa Fredrici in 1866, and they have four children, two of which died when they were young. As far as History Out Loud is concerned, Cody's main interest to us is his creation of the world-famous Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, which was a touring show that travelled around the United States, Great Britain and continental Europe. In 1893, the show had the title Buffalo Bill's Wild West and Congress of Rough Riders of the World, which is quite a mouthful, really.
Yes. Why use 10 words when 100 will do?
Yeah. Each show began with a parade on horseback with participants that included the US and other military, cowboys, of course, Native Americans, and performers from all over the world with horses and colourful costumes. On the bill, there would usually be a main event, also feats of skill, which I'm guessing is things like, I don't know, lassoing, booking broncos, staged races and sideshows. Many historical Western figures participated in the show, and this included Sitting Bull, and he toured with them in 1885.
Okay.
So we should probably say something about Wild West Show Indians at this point. On the podcast, we've talked previously about the great exhibitions in Victorian era and how Indigenous peoples from around the world were plucked from their homes and brought to Europe to be sort of basically stared at and wondered about. From our point of view, it's problematic, to say the least, that this is what they did, you know, sadly. In the case of the Wild West shows, show Indians, as they were known, were hired Native American performers, and they were primarily Lakota from South Dakota reservation. These performers took part in reenacting historic battles and performing dances for the audience. And many veterans from the Great Plains Wars. So am I right in thinking that's when European governments and later the US were embarking on kind of wholesale colonialism?
Yeah, and it's strange, isn't it, to sort of say, why would they participate in this?
Yeah.
the othering of themselves and their people, but people who are marginalized, it's a very complicated relationship that they end up having with the ruling powers that be, yeah. You know, whether it's a religious or a governmental or a cultural ruling power. And yeah, we look at it now and sort of say, why? But, you know, people had to make a living. People, you know, had conflicting loyalties. There's no way that we can really know without a firsthand account from those people at that time. But even then, we would only have a firsthand account of that person's individual motivation. So it's a curious thing to look back on and say, how did you get involved in this? just from my very brief reading up on Buffalo Bill before we started this, you know, his father was an anti-slavery campaigner. His mother was from a Quaker background. They were anti-slavery. He himself had some, you know, fairly progressive views for the time about suffrage and, you know, the rights of Native Americans and things like that. So, you know, maybe in spite of the show, the script that had to be performed because that's what people expected and that's what people wanted to see, you know, maybe their relationship with him was a much more, I don't want to say egalitarian, but there clearly has to have been more than just a financial element to this. And, you know, we can only guess, really.
It's hugely complicated. Lots of blurred boundaries.
Mm.
And many of them went on to act in silent films after they'd appeared in the show. Okay. Which presumably, maybe become famous.
It'd be interesting to see what sort of roles they appeared in, if it continued this, or if they were able to do something a little more, you know, something a little more revolutionary, a little more positive.
My feeling is they probably ended up in Westerns.
Probably. Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah. Cody's headline performers on the show were well known in their own right. This is Annie Oakley and her husband Frank Butler, and they were sharpshooters.
Yeah.
If it's possible to have historical disappointment, I would, because Annie didn't actually tour with the show in Europe, which is sad. She was involved in a bad rail accident in 1901 when the train transporting the show, animals and performers was hit by a freight train. She was so injured, they actually told us she probably wouldn't walk again. She did, but she didn't tour with the show in Europe after that. We should probably say a little bit about her because she's a really interesting woman. She developed hunting skills as a child to provide for her family, which were very poor. They lived in Western Ohio. And at age 15, another early starter, she won a shooting contest against Butler, who at the time was an experienced marksman. He must have been thinking, oh, come on then, you know, let's see what you've got, kid.
Yeah.
And then she beats him and they eventually get married, hopefully a bit later on.
It was one year later. I looked it up.
Oh no.
I know. He's 13 years her senior, which was the style at the time, unfortunately. But they did stay married forever, so.
Okay.
But it would have been incredible for her to rise above the rest, because like I said earlier, everybody had guns back then. So for her to be so good that she was, you know, that she was considered exceptional, you know, she had a much bigger pool of competitors, really.
Yeah.
In that sense. So she must have really been something.
She was.
I would have loved to see her as well.
It said she could shoot a cigar out of her husband's lips.
Wow. That's trust there.
That is trust, yeah. And it gets better. It said she could split a playing card edge on at 30 paces.
Yeah.
I'm not hugely confident about that, really. I mean, you have to wonder if there's any sleight of hand involved in some of these feats. I mean, I don't want to do her down, but it is a show after all. But I mean, maybe she could. I'd like to believe she could. There is actually grainy old footage that you can find online of her shooting coins that have been thrown up in the air.
Oh.
Yeah. So look out for that. Yeah. No, I'd have loved to have seen her. She earned more than anyone else on the shows except Buffalo Bill himself.
Good for her. Again, I like her. I like her a lot.
So the Wild West tours, they visited Europe, France, Belgium, Netherlands, Austria, to name a few places. While in Rome, a delegation from the show actually met Pope Leo VIII.
Okay.
Yeah.
shoot a cigar out of his mouth?
Yeah. Bill wanted to perform in the Colosseum, of course, but his condition made it unsuitable, so he was pretty disappointed about that.
That's a shame.
Yeah. In the UK, the show was popular with the royal family. Queen Victoria loved it. There was a performance at her Golden Jubilee in 1887, and other royals, King Edward VII and future King George V, were enthusiasts also. Buffalo Bill and his show was world famous by the end of the 19th century, it's fair to say, which is quite amazing, really, isn't it? But these tours, they were relentless, you know. So it's, I suppose that's what would have happened. So the Wild West show toured throughout Great Britain during 1902, 1903, and 1904, performing in nearly every city large enough to support it. And this, of course, includes Halifax, which, I mean, we think of it as small now, but back in the day, it was pretty important.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The performance in Halifax was to take place on October the 8th, 1903, and a poster distributed at the time describes it as an absolutely original and heroic enterprise of inimitable luster.
Mm.
That's quite a florid way of describing something. That's the way they did it then.
Yep.
The entrance fee to get in, so it says it was 1 shilling, 2 shillings, 3 shillings, and a box was costing 4 shillings, 5 shillings, and I think it's 66 pence.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a packed tour, playing some venues for just one day. And I mean, in West Yorkshire, there were shows in Leeds, Bradford, Keighley. Then it came to Halifax, and then I think there was a show after that in Wakefield. According to adverts, and these chiefly appeared in the good old Halifax Evening Courier, attractions at the show would include Russian Cossacks.
Very American.
Yeah. Bedouin Arabs, American cowboys and girls, Red Indians, Native Americans to you and me.
Yes.
Cubans, Mexicans, bucking broncos, and reenactments of scenes of border life on the Western American plains. So I don't know whether you've ever seen any of the posters in the newspapers, but they are quite eye-catching.
No, I haven't actually.
I might try and get some of those on social media so people can see. And then there was something that they described as the historic military spectacle of the Battle of San Juan Hill.
Ah, okay. Texas.
Depicting an incident in the Spanish-American War. So it's quite interesting to know that the Spaniards were actually played by the Native Americans.
Wow.
Doubling up for the performance.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
I don't want to make it, oh, they all look the same joke, but yeah, back then that kind of was the prevailing attitude, wasn't it?
So there's an interesting quote in the Halifax Evening Courier, which appeared just prior to the event, and this quote's dated from the 1st of October, 1903, and it's about the participation of Native Americans in these shows. So it's quite a grainy text here, so I'll do my best to read it. So it says, Colonel Cody had the greatest difficulty in getting his first collection of Indians together. as the Indians could not understand how a large gathering of whites could take place for the purpose of seeing a body of Indians, unless the idea of slaughtering the Indians was included in the program.
I wonder where they got that idea from. My goodness.
I know.
Yeah.
Once the Redskins began to realize that the influence of the white man was not always against their interests, they were much more easy to manage. So it's quite an interesting quote, really, for so many reasons. And I suppose we have to remember that the time it was written, but words like manage, Redskins, obviously, and also the whole idea that they had to be persuaded. So, you know, it's worrying.
It goes back to what we were saying about why would you participate in this? And
yeah.
Language gives away so much. The language that we choose to use when talking about other people or situations, really, sometimes it betrays more than we want it to, I think, about what our thought processes are. Because even in this light, it's still about managing them. It's still about corralling them.
Exactly.
Buffalo Bill the Teamster is having to manage his Indians.
Yeah. Phrases employed by Cody in his posters, so these are in quotation marks, virile, muscular, heroic manhood. The mounted warriors of the world. So it's quite a lot of machismo going on, really, which you would expect, I suppose.
But again, it's that racialized idea of these other people as being overly physical and, you know, strong and muscular, and say, like, you saw the same sort of terminology employed against, you know, black men during slavery and after slavery, and even still now to some degree, like this idea that they're, you know, natural athletes.
Yeah,
it's not something I'd ever really thought about in relation to Native Americans, but it's being employed here in the same context, isn't it? But all these things are being written for white people. They're being written for us as the audience, and so it's going to play into those cultural ideas of who these people are and what their, you know, what their talents are.
So the show eventually arrived in Halifax on 3 special trains, and there were 50 coaches in all, and it arrived at Pelham train station, which doesn't exist now, but presumably that was the main station. And it arrived in the early hours of the morning on the 8th. And the first train was at 3 a.m. Then there was one at 3:30 and then one at 4 a.m. The show was to be held on Savile Park, which is a great place really for it, the only place, for which the corporation received a sum of £40. So there's a little quote, again, from the Halifax Evening Courier, and this was dated on the 8th. Of October 1903, about the actual arrival. When people living on the side of the moor drew up their blinds in the morning, they found that already several marquees had been erected and workmen were as busy as bees. So, yeah, you can imagine, can't you? Just like getting up, just seeing it's like half built already. The organisation it must have taken is quite incredible, and I mean the equipment that was included. So they had canvassing for over 14,000 spectators to cover 3 sides of the ground. The dining tent for the performers accommodated 600 people, so that's one tent at any one time, and all could be fed within 35 minutes. So you know,
that's impressive.
There's another quote, actually, from the Halifax Evening Courier about the dining tent. This is from presumably the reporter they sent out, the reporter on the ground, who got to see the inside. And again, the print's not that great. I shall attempt to read it. Yeah. Here, there is accommodation for several hundred persons at one time. This marquee is the first which is unloaded in the morning, and within 35 minutes, breakfast is ready for 500 people. Everybody fares alike, and even Colonel Cody may often be seen there, seated near the entrance. Everybody has a chance of partaking of a good square meal. 10 cooks and 60 waiters are employed. The daily consumption includes 1,400 pounds of fresh meat, 700 pounds of potatoes, 300 pounds of vegetables, and 450 pounds of bread. So that, I mean, that's quite substantial, isn't it? At least he was feeding them well, you know.
There is that, there is that. I'm interested in all that bread.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, considering what they have to do, I mean, you'd have to have a lot of food, really. You know, keep your strength up. Other things that was included in the equipment. So they'd have 2 mobile shoeing forges, electric lighting, because a lot of the performances that they did in these tours were night performances.
Mm.
There were 700 people and 500 animals. With regards to the horses, we learn an interesting fact from, again, Halifax Evening Courier, from the same reporter. And he says, "We were shown the stables, canvas, of course. Here, rough riders were taking their ease, most of them having a nap, and near them were their horses. It is a general belief that these animals are specially trained for the purpose. This, however, is incorrect. The horses come direct from the ranches of Wyoming, USA, and but a few weeks previous to the appearance of the exhibition in London, were roaming in a perfectly wild manner over the vast prairies of that state." So that's amazing, isn't it? They've not even got trained horses. They've just kind of corralled a few wild, well, not a few, a lot.
It makes you wonder how they got them over here in one piece if they were that wild. What's an experience being shipped over on a boat would be like. They're either going to be just completely beyond themselves, or this is more of the storytelling. I don't know.
They must have had to have some training.
Mm.
My guess is that in order to have animals to take on these huge tours, animal welfare isn't going to be top of the agenda.
No.
Acquiring horses that belong to people, or, you know, that are trained and everything, might be just more expensive. It might be cheaper just to get a bunch of horses that were roaming wild. It sounds horrible, I know, but I mean, we don't know that, but it's a possibility. This same reporter actually got to meet Buffalo Bill in his own private tent. And so he has a little something to say about this. He says, "He's a typical Yankee in appearance and easy of approach. Step right inside," said he. Shook hands, offered a chair and the usual courtesies in the space of 1 minute. Evidently, he had a business head on his shoulders, beside being a clever rider, and our reporter did not remain to take up his valuable time more than 3 minutes, during which he learned that the colonel never catches a cold. Wow. I mean, of all the things you could say about him, and that's what he's going to report. Anyway, high-class journalism.
He only had 3 minutes, I guess.
I guess, yeah. "If he had been able to stand this, in quotation marks, summer without a cold, well, he's done well." So, yeah, that's true, I suppose. But part of me wonders about that, just as a slight aside, is that when we think back to his father dying of respiratory illness, you know, you'd think to yourself, why would he sort of proclaim he never gets colds in this situation? But
I've been working on this this Friends of a Graveyard project, and we've been researching just random graves of people who were in there, and it's amazing how many people are dying of just bronchitis, you know, bronchitis or pneumonia on their death certificates, and, you know, let alone consumption or tuberculosis or anything like that. And I think we forget just how pervasive respiratory illnesses were and how deadly they were. So it probably, yeah, it is a big thing to be able to say, I've never had a cold, because people died from colds in 1903, you know? So
okay, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt on that one. And the reporter. So there was to be an afternoon and an evening performance, and the poster stated that the entire grand program would take place twice daily, come rain or shine. However, heavy rain and high winds at Bradford meant their evening performance was cancelled, and there were rumours that the evening performance at Halifax may need to be cancelled as well. But it went ahead in spite of driving rain. It was promised by Major Burke, who was Cody's longtime friend and associate, who he probably sent out to do press junkets and things.
Mm.
In this regard, Buffalo Bill was keeping faith with the public. So I think they, you know, they attempted to put on the show what in whatever circumstances they found, you know.
Yeah.
And he said that Halifax would witness the full exhibition on the same scale and magnitude and as complete as in London, Rome, Vienna, Paris, and New York. So that's pretty good, isn't it, really?
Mm.
Halifax gets to see this amazing thing. Perhaps we could finish this episode with a quote from a local newspaper, which is more of a review after the event. Sadly, I don't have a date for this or which paper it is. It was in the brown envelopes and it didn't, you know, it's just like been printed out, but not.
No.
No date. It happens. But I'm guessing it's the Courier because they seem to have been the ones reporting on it before the event. And it gives quite a dramatic description of what unfolded during the evening performance. So the attendance both in the afternoon and evening was very large, though the chilly discomfort of the perpetual rain could not have added to the pleasure of either the spectators or the performers. At night, the effect was very weird. The steely glitter of the electric lights shone in the mist rising from the moist ground, and even the two powerful searchlights could not add much brightness to the scene.
Wow.
Yeah. The steady downpour did not, however, rob the galloping steeds of their mettle or their courageous riders of their pluck. And so the programme of rough riding from the opening to the closing review took place as announced. And what curtailment was made was merciful alike to performers and the audience. All the well-known elements were in the show. Cowboys, Cossacks, Mexicans, Arabs and Indians dashed about the ring, uttering their cries, which stir the pulse strangely, lighting the eerie gloom with bright flashes of colour.
It sounds like something, doesn't it? We can't imagine what, in that time, like what just intense sensory input this whole show would have been, you know, really something else.
Yeah. I have to say, I'm kind of envious, really. I mean, we have all the technology now, but that kind of thing must have been so exciting to attend.
If it could have penicillin and suffrage, I'd like to go back to that time and be able to experience things like that as they were intended to be experienced. And it sounds exhausting even to hear about how much energy it took to put the show on and what their touring schedule is like and everything. It must have really been, you know, beyond what we can really think of in terms of a day after day after day.
Yeah.
You know, show.
Thank you for joining me on this episode, Sarah, once again, and filling us in on some American history.
Just the extra little details.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me on. This is, I spent most of my childhood thinking Buffalo Bill and Wild Bill Hickok were the same person. So it's nice to be reminded that no, they were two different people. Although they did tour together, so that makes it complicated. But yeah, thank you for not confusing me. Yes, yes. Wild Bill was part of this show apparently at one point.
God.
So I know. I'm grateful we didn't try and get into that.
You've been listening to History Out Loud, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries, produced and presented by Jill Carpenter and Sarah Browning. Well, that's it from History Out Loud for 2022. Thank you for listening. Have no fear, we'll be back in 2023. We have a lineup of fabulous guests that I can't wait to meet and chat with. So see you then.